Okay, so microwaves. I want to talk about this.
Freaking microwaves.
So I told you about...
fry your brain.
I told you about how...
tinfoil pyramid on your head.
So the microwave at work connected to the toast, the same thing a toaster is. Actually, I think we talked about this and we said we'd talk about it on the post show.
Yes.
So let me explain. So at work, we have a microwave and a toaster oven, and there's a...
Get on mic, man.
Sorry. We have a microwave and a toaster oven, and there is a... They found that if you plugged in the microwave and toaster oven at the same time, it would blow the circuit. Or it would...
Trip
the circuit.
Yeah.
And so instead of putting up a sign that said this would trip the circuit, someone put up a sign that said if you run the microwave and the toaster at the same time, this would cause the Earth to plummet into the sun. Knock the Earth out of orbit and cause the plummet into the sun. So, of course, I had to see what kind of energy that would require. Fortunately, Wolfram Alpha is the perfect answer for this, because you can just simply get the Earth's orbital velocity and change that into joules. And assume that, you know, if you impart that amount of energy in joules into the Earth's orbit, you would essentially stop it and have it plummet to the sun. But the problem is turning that into watts, because the microwaves work on watts. And the thing is that watts are power as opposed to energy. Mm-hmm. And power is energy over time.
Right.
And so I had to say, okay, well, we're talking about something that will happen relatively quickly, tripping a circuit breaker. So I'm going to say take it into, because what it is it's time cubed. Because you say, what? Time cubed? It's just over time months. Well, no, because when you measure joules, joules are actually measured over C squared. Power is measured, energy is measured over C squared, C being a unit of time. And so, like when you measure electrovolts, et cetera, electron volts, those are all measured over C squared. And when you understand relativity, when you get into the math of relativity, you understand why this is. But this is the case. So that's why it's cube, time cube, but it's actually... So ignore that part.
Actually,
watch energy over time. So what I did is I said, okay, if you take this joules and put it...
Actually, I think you're wrong. A joule is equivalent to a watt, because there's watt hours and kilowatt hours, and that is...
A joule... Or let's put it this way, a watt, 1 watt is 1 joule per second. Very easy.
Which is also 1 volt amp.
Are they exactly the same?
1 volt, a volt times an amp is a watt.
A volt times an amp is a watt.
Yes, so 1 volt amp, and there's actually a difference between watts and volt amps if you have an inductive load versus a resistive load. Called a power factor. It's stuff I barely understand, and I'm not an electrical engineer, so it's stuff I barely understand, and stuff I'm not qualified to describe on the post show.
Well, anyway, but
a resistive... sorry, go ahead, you go, and then I'll try to go.
Okay,
on.
So I got the number, and I put the number in watts, because I translated into per second, this amount of energy per second. So I assumed that you could create the amount of energy to stop the Earth in 1 second. And I put that amount there. So the amount is some ridiculous number. And it's like 10 to the 20, 10 to the 35 or something. But I said, what kind of, you know, how can I measure that in something that's relatable? And fortunately, Wolfram Alpha gave me the answer. And that is... nominal solar luminosity.
How's that relatable?
It turns out that this energy is roughly 80 days of nominal solar luminosity.
So 80 days sun's energy?
Of the nominal sun's energy. Nominal is kind of it's normal model, basically. Mm-hmm. So if you take 80 days of the sun's energy, which, you know, to the sun, which lasts 10 billion years, not a lot of energy, not a huge amount, but that's how much orbital velocity is in the Earth.
Yeah. So generally, your counter joke was good. Tripping a breaker is not so exact. You could run it over current for 20, 30 seconds before it'll pop.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, the 1 second might have amplified your number.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I had to put some factor in there.
Right. If I was doing it, I probably would have said 15 seconds, 20 seconds, somewhere in there. But, you know, it's a ridiculous statement.
Yes.
Countered by ridiculous pseudo-math.
The fun thing was being able to do a back-of-the-envelope calculation without really knowing how to do a back-of-the-envelope calculation.
Right.
You're having the ability, and Wolfram Alfred gives you that, to take these abstract things, you know, to us that are completely abstract.
Right. So we were talking before we started recording about volts, amps, watts, joules,
yeah,
and stuff. And I was trying to, and this is actually a field where I might have some information over Greg, so let me feel smart here for a second and try, but I'm not sure I have the right answer. He was asking what a volt is, what a watt is. And the best answer I had off the top of my head, I'm still trying to dig deeper. If you use the garden hose analogy, which is a very popular analogy with electricity,
right,
volts are the pressure of the hose. So you could have, you know, a 1-inch garden hose that is running at just a trickle or something.
Right.
That would be low voltage, you know, 5 volts. And you could have the thing open up at full blast. It's shooting halfway across your yard. And that could be 110 volts, right? So it's the pressure of the electrons flowing through the cable. Where amps, which is current, is the amount of electrons flowing. So that's not the pressure, but that is the diameter of the garden hose. So if you're comparing a garden hose to a sewer pipe, you know, it's the kind of thing that's like, it's not the volts that'll kill you, because an electric shock is like thousands of volts, but it's like no amps. Where a 1-amp shock of reasonable volts could kill you, because imagine a 6-foot sewer pipe of water plowing into you.
I think over your heart, like 0.6 amps will stop it.
Right. I mean, just stick with the water analogy. Imagine getting bowled over by a 6-foot sewer pipe full of water versus getting sprayed by a garden hose at full pressure. You know, one's going to hurt, I mean, maybe hurt just a little bit, but one is going to knock you over and push you across the yard.
Right.
And that's what current does, is it knocks you over and pushes you across the yard.
Right, but so the question is one of them energy and one of them power? So is one of them...
So power is...
And like I said, energy volts times over amps. Time squared, and energy is over time cubed.
So without trying to reconcile it exactly to what you said, here's my understanding of things.
Okay.
You take a volt times an amp. So if you have 110 volts, which is your normal house power here in the United States, times 1 amp, that's 110 watts. Volts times amps equals watts. So you have 110 watts. So if you had a 110-watt light bulb,
and that would be, according to my information, 110 joules per second. Joules per second. Because a watt is a joule per second.
Right. So, but a watt doesn't have time yet. It's just volts times...
A watt does have time, because a watt is joules per second. A watt is a measure of time. Just like...
But a watt is...
Just like a light year is a measure of time.
So, okay, let's see. Volt is... I'm kind of thinking out loud here now. So I guess a volt is energy.
A year is not a measure of time. A year is a measure of time.
Amp is current. Energy
distance.
Energy times current is power. But, you know, our electricity is built on watt hours or kilowatt hours, right? That's what you pay. You pay
on kilowatt.
So much
hours,
per kilowatt hours. So that's the first time time comes into it. You know, it's watts times hours. So if you have a light bulb that is using 10 watts and you run it for 10 hours, that is 100 watt hours.
Right.
So, I mean, that's where time comes into play. Where a watt by itself is... Isn't it more of a point in time thing where it's at any point it's using this much power, and then it depends on how long it's drawing that power, which is, isn't horse, like, that gets into a watt hour is equivalent to horsepower. That is the, like, work. That is the, what's the crap? It's not energy. It's not power. It's, is it?
This is something we have to look up because we don't have.
I did know this, but I've forgotten the details.
This is stuff that, yeah, you forget over time when you're not using it.
Because, yeah, there's a volt, there's an amp. They're separate. Volt times amps. So, and then we're talking about inductive versus resistive loads.
Right.
If you have a resistive load, like computer stuff, minus the hard drives, it a power factor of close to one. So a volt times an amp is... equals a watt. But if you have like motors, where this is the part I don't intuitively understand. I know what I know, mm-hmm. but I don't know why that is true. When you have things like motors, it's an inductive load, and maybe it has something to do with the momentum of the moving magnets or something. That's my best guess. But the power factor is different. So your volt amps, volt times amps, is different than your watts, actually, because of the power factor in there. It's like a it might be up to 15 to 20% less or more because of the inductive load.
Okay. I'm kind of lost. Probably because I'm thinking about my next topic already.
It could be. I wish I knew this shit like Greg knows his quantum mechanics. There's your next topic, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wish I knew this shit like Greg knows about quantum mechanics, because it's a rare day where I know more about a topic than Greg
yeah.
does. And but I don't know enough about electrical engineering and power factors. I've read it. I know why it's there. But I don't intuitively get it to explain it.
Well, let me go on to my topic, and we'll see if this makes more sense. I'm going to try to deal with it in a different sort of way. But I was trying to kind of understand, because there's information, more information that looks like a Higgs discovery announcement is imminent. So 5 sigma, you know, detection of the Higgs. And I was trying to kind of understand the Higgs mechanism, and... It's really confusing because the analogy they give you, which is that okay, if you're going through a room without a lot of people and you're not a celebrity, you go through it fast. Whereas if you're a celebrity, the people will tend to crowd around you, and that will make it harder for you to move through the room. And those people are the Higgs bosons that are attracted to you, and so you have more mass, and it's harder for you to move through the room.
So what, you're an average particle, but the Higgs think you're famous?
The analogy is that, okay, so if you're a photon, you're not famous. You move through the room really quickly, because people are not interested
right.
in you.
But
if you're an electron, you're only slightly famous. If you're a top quark, you're really heavy, and you're really famous.
Oh, but the Higgs are the average people, the crowd that might or might not.
The Higgs is the crowd that forms around you that slows you down. That's the analogy that's sort of given.
Well, that kind of, I mean, I don't know where you're going, but I mean that kind of is a cool analogy, because, you know, applying intuitive characteristics to these elementary particles, you know, I know, I've been told that the Higgs particle is the particle that gives mass to particles. And to everyone listening, except for the few, you know, theoretical physicists, you know, armchair theoretical physicists that, you know, are in kin with you, you know, they don't get how particles give attributes or give mass or give things like that. So when you say that the room is full of Higgs particles and certain kinds of particles are famous and certain kinds aren't, and they slow them down because they're bothering them, you know, it definitely intuitively makes sense.
It gives a very nice intuitive picture. It is... Here's the problem. It's completely wrong. completely. It is absolutely... It bears no resemblance to what is actually going on.
Does it bear no resemblance to how it actually works?
No,
or does it bear, or does it bear no resemblance to the what's the word I'm looking for? It bears no. So yes, absolutely. Higgs particles aren't, you know, paparazzi slowing people down, but is it a reasonable facsimile of? To understand the concept.
No.
I mean, because you're probably going to get into now about waves collapsing and emitting particles that cause mass.
No, I mean, it's just...
And
I
no
mean,
one can understand that.
I understand that no one can understand it. Again, try to describe it in a way that's a little bit... That is a little bit more descriptive. A little more descriptive. But it's certainly less intuitive. But it's more along the lines of how it works. And the best analogy that people have been able to come up with is a Mexican hat. Okay?
Okay.
So, first of all, you have to accept this idea that there's a field. There are many fields. But there are these fields that are throughout all of space. And... amongst these fields, the electromagnetic field, there's the electron field, there's the muon field, there's a proton field, and there's a Higgs field. Okay? Now, the interesting thing about the Higgs field is that it has a very interesting aspect, which is that it's a non-zero value in general. So this is... most of the fields are roughly close to zero. More or less. They have a non-zero vacuum excitation, but the Higgs field, the value is pretty high. It's around 270 electron volts, giga electron volts. It's pretty high. So there's this energy field that is sort of there in all of space, and the idea behind getting the Higgs particle there is if you whack the field hard enough, you'll sort of excited enough to make the field wobble, and that generates what we call the Higgs particle. But the idea is this Mexican hat, which is sort of this, you have this or a better thing, maybe it's easier to conceptualize, is the bottom of a wine bottle. Okay, so you have a it's a circle,
the punt,
it's got a indentation.
The punt. We got beer geeks on the line. They know what a punt on the bottom of a bottle is.
But you know, it's got an indentation up top, which is circular, and then it's got it has a bottom to it that kind of curls up at the edges, that turns to the bottom. So if you take that, you can see.
Oh, so you want to have the, so
that.
You got to imagine
with a rim.
You have to imagine the wine bottle sitting upright, not upside down.
Yes.
Okay.
So a circular hat with a rim, circular Mexican hat with a rim, is kind of the same way. And so you take that, and that is a very symmetrical system, right? Because from all sides it looks the same. You can turn it, you can twist it around chirally, and it looks the same. And the idea is that the Higgs particle, you can think of as a ball at the top of this. And so it's a ball that is at the top of the very top of this hat is the Higgs. And this is the state
inside or outside the hat?
On the top of the hat outside.
Okay.
It's a round ball. Okay. So the Higgs is at the state of the universe when the universe is very hot, and when the system is very hot. It's a symmetrical system. It's very so. You have this hat and you have this ball sitting at the top of the hat. And when things cool down, the ball rolls to the bottom and to the rim. So the system is the symmetry of the system is breaking. The ball itself retains its symmetry because it's a ball. The hat retains its symmetry. But the system of the hat and the ball loses its
symmetry. So it would be off balance if the thing was balanced on a point.
And it falls into this divot.
Okay. Got it.
Okay. So that's where the Higgs is sort of presently in all of space that's not highly energized like what we can do in the LHC. And so the idea is that if you the other weird thing
it'll
is
it'll roll
that,
around the rim of the hat. Is that
well, that's well, that's the weird thing about it is that the there are areas in the rim of the hat where the Higgs could be massless, but those are taken up by the other gauge fields. It's really
yeah,
weird.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah, so imagine that you have essentially a slice of this hat. That the Higgs kind of sits then sort of in the bottom. And if you whack it hard enough, it'll oscillate enough to kind of pop out just briefly.
So when you say pop out, does it roll around the rim or does it actually roll back up onto the top of
it
the
hat? It kind of rolls up onto the rim. Like slightly up. It doesn't go up the
it
top.
It rolls up the crown of the hat, though.
Right, right. Mathematically speaking, it rolls up the top of the hat, and
okay.
That...
Let's get to the point. Why do I care?
Okay. The interesting thing about why this is interesting to me was because it started getting me thinking and really interested in quantum fields, in the idea that particles aren't particles that we think of. I mean, we've talked about this concept before, but they're really perturbations in fields. And the best way to think about this is, so you think about two electrons, okay, in a system. Just think about two electrons. Yeah, when you roughly think about it, you think about two balls, right?
Okay.
Okay. Now imagine that instead of two balls, you're thinking about a field, okay? So, but these two electrons are represented by bumps in the field, bumps of a regular distribution of a certain absolute distribution.
Okay.
So they're quanta. They have to be this. They can't be any lower. They can't be any higher. They are this distribution. So those are they run around a range in the field in all different ways. But you have this field. You have these two electrons or these two bumps that are just running around this field. You can think about it as sort of a two-dimensional field with these bumps in it, right? Okay. Now take away the electrons. What do you have? You still have the field. The field is there. Right.
Okay.
The field remains. The reason why this came up is because I was looking into virtual particles. Because virtual particles are, this sort of this big thing about how the universe is empty space is filled with virtual particles that pop in and out of existence. That's what we're told. Completely wrong. You have this field, and the problem with this field is that, like I said, they all have a non-zero expectation value. They're not nearly as large in energy as the Higgs, but they have some energy going through. They have these little kind of wiggly bumps that happen through them. These bumps never get to the point where they are a full electron. They never get to the point where they're full quanta. But they happen. In fact, they happen more often when actual electrons are nearing each other and they sort of distort the fields around them. But you can think about it like this little small perturbation in a field. Well, the problem is that just this perturbation in the field is not enough. Because when you think about an electron, you realize that an electron is coupled to a charge field. So by the fact that there's a little bump, just a little bit, there's also a little bump in a charge field.
I'm trying to hopefully come back to something I'm getting, because
okay.
I am lost. I don't get this shit.
What I see is I see in my mind a kind of, I'm looking at like a round table, and a round table has this red grid, okay? And this grid, if there's an electron there, it's this kind of three-dimensional sort of bump that
okay.
moves around this grid. And if the electron isn't there, it's mostly flat, but it's a little wavy in parts. It kind of randomly kind of fluctuates a little bit.
Okay.
And then you imagine another field, another thing that's intersecting that, and sort of, let's say, parallel or or not parallel, but at the oblique angle. So that whenever that thing moves a little bit, the other field also moves a little bit.
Dude, I'm
you're lost.
This cake's kicked. I'm out of here.
All right.
I'm done. I'm yawning. I can't stop it. I need to wrap this up.
All right. Well, let me get to one thing that I think is interesting, and you'll see if you like it or not. Because the interesting question was asked, which, okay, so you have a positron.
Okay.
All right. So that's a positive electron, right? Mm-hmm. It's a CP reverse electron. Why does that not? So that annihilates with an electron. Why does a positron not annihilate with a proton?
Mass is different.
Right. So you have a positive and a negative electron, or to think of it. So why does a positron with a negative proton, why don't they annihilate?
Because they're different parts. They're not all opposite.
That's basically the answer. But really, what you have to think about is this field picture again. Because, okay, so you have this field, and you have to think about it like there's actually sort of a bottom and a top to the field, right? So when there's an electron, it's kind of sucking up that top bit, that bottom bit. And when there's a positron, it's kind of below it, and it's sucking down that bottom bit. It's basically creating a hole. And when these interact, they fill each other like keys. They kind of snap into each other, and they create a lot of energy. Whereas when these fields are not the same fields, mm-hmm. they simply don't interact the same way.
Sure. Okay. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you know, because a positron has, you know, very little mass.
Yeah.
It's equivalent to a positive charged electron, where a negatively charged proton has different quarks in it. It's just different stuff.
I mean, even though the charges are different, and therefore you might think they would annihilate, they don't, because they don't fit that lock and key. Mm-hmm.
Right. That part makes sense. I'm not sure what the last 20 minutes means, though.
Trying...
Oh, you smell that? We're outside? Skunk. You smell that?
No.
You don't smell the skunk?
No, I smell kind of a fire. I smell like...
No, there's a skunk. Some skunk went off nearby.
Oh, that's certainly possible. Anyway, Jeff is drunk, and I'm probably explaining this poorly, so...
Yeah, it's boring.
Sorry.
Sorry, yeah, I thought we were going somewhere, but like, what seems like 10 minutes ago, I was like, you better fucking get somewhere, because you're getting nowhere.
Now I smell the skunk. I was trying to give you an interesting way of picturing how quantum fields interact, but I guess I failed.
I mean, I was visualizing the electron bump on the field, and when there's no electron, there's fluctuation and waves. But
yeah,
I didn't get anything beyond that. And I didn't get any tie-in.
Well, the point is that there's coupling between the different fields. And so the weird thing is that a photon, when moving along as a photon, will at certain aspects stop becoming a photon and become a pair, an electron-positron pair that will then annihilate and turn back into a photon. If you look at the math in one way, but if you look at the fields, you get a better understanding of why this takes place. And I am not sober enough to, I'm not a good enough explainer to explain this right now.
Just like how I can explain how watts and watt hours are different.
I'm more sober than I'm pretty sober right now, but it was perfect in my head before we started, but now I'm confused about it. That means I don't really understand it, and that's okay. That's okay.
All right, wrapping this up. All right. I need to go to sleep.
See ya.